Today we have some beautiful symbols of understanding stewardship. We don't have, well, I'm sure in big businesses we have this, where you have the owner of the business, and then you have the, you know, chief executive officer or such, who takes care of, well, it's kind of funny to say a chief executive officer and say take care of the everyday duties and things, but of a smaller business, you know, the owner has all of these things, he has this property, he has these things to manage, to create a reality in which there's someone that is paid to manage all of that, right? That's the ideal, right? Got enough stuff that you got to hire somebody to manage it, right? This idea of stewardship, it was very common in Jesus' time to have a household and to have an employee whose whole job was to be the steward of them. Kings had them, the steward of the palace, steward of royal households and things. Today, you see someone's getting fired. Haman's been doing a good job, he's getting fired. And God's going to replace him, and he's already named the replacement. He's going to take his robe and put it on him, his sash and put him on him. He's going to take his keys, the keys to the gates, the keys that open and allow things to come in and go out, and then the doors are shut and they're shut. I'm going to give him the keys. So we see the model of stewardship. We see the symbols of stewardship, the responsibility of it, that allows us to see into the gospel text and to see in the conversation that Jesus is having with Peter a little bit about stewardship. One of our parishioners gave me something for show and tell. Okay, when we talk about keys, we're talking about things like this, right? You know, a foot long, heavy. Imagine how many keys you got on your keychain right now, right? And replace those with these, right? It was very common for a steward who had the key to the gate that would open, one gate that would open in for the house. They didn't have like the fire codes that we do now. One gate for the whole household, one key. It's very common that they would have strings here on their shoulder, a lanyard of some sort, and it would be attached right there to their shoulder. Now, what that does is it also designates the one that's got the key on the shoulder as the steward of the household. And so keys become a symbol of authority, a symbol of power, because they were worn on the shoulder. At first, I'm sure it was just because their heaviness and the sake of them, but after a while, it became symbolic of their power and authority. Where do we see that? Well, talk about Peter and the keys. We have it depicted in the window here in the church. We also see that in the Vatican City flag, we have two keys that are crossed in there. It's the whole connection with the gospel text that we see today. In this conversation, we see Jesus asking the people, his disciples, who do people, say that I am? Not the group of disciples, not those who are close to him, the people. What are they saying? And he says, who do they say that the Son of Man is? Right? I want to ask you the question, who's the Son of Man? Right? It's Jesus, but the thing from the book of Daniel, right? The image that Daniel sees, and sees one like a Son of Man coming to the throne of God and receiving power and dominion and all of these things, right? This prophetic, this image of the one that is coming. You know, are you the Son of Man? Are you the Son of Man? Are you that one that Daniel prophesied and saw in his vision that was receiving, you know, lordship and power and all of these things? Jesus says, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And in his next question, he says, who do you say that I am? So he is making that connection. He is declaring, I am the Son of Man. I am the one. That image, is that vision was about me. So he first asked the question, who do they say the Son of Man is? And they're like, John the Baptist, come back from life, Jeremiah, the prophet, the one that Moses foretold, would be like him and would see and know God face to face and things like that. All of these things are complementary, right? All of the things they're saying, not a single thing that the people are saying about Jesus is bad, is it? But it's not true. You see, we have to make that distinction, my brothers and sisters, because in our culture today, that word truth, they're going to start spelling it with four letters, okay? Because it is becoming a bad word, a four-letter word, truth. It is. Because it's not about whether things are true or not. There is no truth. It's just about like good and good feelings and you do you and I'll do me and all of these things and such. All of the things that they're saying about Jesus are good. They're comparing him with the prophets of old. They're comparing him in these things and all of this stuff, but it's not true. This is important that we make this distinction. Because there are a lot of people who will say very complimentary things about Jesus. Oh, he was the wisest sage. He was this, he was that. You know, I wish I could find a Christian that actually did what Jesus said to do. All of these kinds of little snide comments they make about, you know, because I know Jesus more than you and I'm not even a Christian and blah, 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 all these things. I don't know if you've heard it, I've heard it. But they don't know who Jesus is. He is not a wise sage. He is more than that. He's not a prophet of old. He is more than that. And so while they're saying all these complimentary things about him, it's not true. So then Jesus turns to the ones who have been with him, have been around him, have been walking with him. There's a difference, right? The others have not been walking with him. These have been walking with him. Who do you say that I am? How important it is, time together, in order to come to greater truth about anyone. You posit the thought of knowing someone, but never even, you know, we get caught up in it. We use words we don't fully mean when we say, I've got a friend that's blah, blah, blah. Oh, what's his name? His name, son of a gun. I should have thought of it before I opened my mouth. Right? We've categorized somebody as a friend and we can't even remember their name. We do that, do we not? We use that word friend too much. I have an acquaintance. I know of someone, right? To spend time with someone is to know them. So Jesus wants to know their opinion. Who do you say that I am? And Peter says the perfect textbook response. You are the Christ, the Messiah, the anointed one, the one that we've been all waiting for centuries. You are the one, the Son of the living God. Baltimore Catechism, ka-chunk, right? I don't even know what paragraph that is, but I'm sure it's in there, right? Who is Jesus? The anointed one, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Amen. True. True, 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 true. And Jesus looks at him and says, bro, and I'm paraphrasing, right? Bro, you didn't get this from this. This flesh and blood that's standing in front of you did not reveal that to you. You've received that from my Father. This is a grace that is given to you to make that declaration. And it's not by what you see or what you touch that you've come to that revelation. And so then Jesus looks at him and something interesting happens. You see, when we know God in truth, we are revealed. It's because we're made in the image and likeness of God. As God is revealed in truth, as we know him more and more and more and more in truth, we are revealed more and more and more in truth. Simon, son of Jonah, today becomes Petrus. If you remember from the movie The Passion of the Christ, they keep calling Peter Kepha in the Aramaic. Kepha, rock. We have an English version of that, rocky. Kepha, you are Kepha. And upon this Kepha I will build my church, and the gates of the netherworld shall not prevail against it. You see, as we know God, we are revealed. We stand before truth. It's like a nuclear reactor. You cannot stand before it and not be changed. And that's a negative example. A good example is you before God in truth, you become truthed, verified, drawn into the truth, purified in truth. It's so important, my brothers and sisters. It's so important because living our lives, we are constantly lied to. We are constantly lied to. And we need the truth to speak to our hearts about who God is and who we are. In this encounter, we see, in the gospel writer makes it very clear to us the context. If the context was not important, he would have not put it in. Where are they? It says Caesarea Philippi. Well, what's historic about Caesarea Philippi? Look it up. Caesarea Philippi was a place in which there was this massive spring that would spring up from the earth, and there was a huge rock that seemingly was covering it. The legends were that if that rock were to remove, the whole world would be flooded because of that massive spring. The rock was holding it from doing that. The cave underneath the rock where the spring was, where the pagans used to sacrifice animals and throw them into the spring, was called the Gates of Hades, the Gates of Hell. The Romans built a temple on top of that rock and dedicated it to Caesar Augustus, to a man they wanted to worship as God. So this is the background. That's the context. Again, if the gospel writer, if the context wasn't important, the gospel writer would not have made reference to the location. It is in the backdrop of all of this stuff. You can even see in the window, they tried to depict it, a huge rock. And it's funny because they make the Roman temple look like a medieval church, because that's what their perspective was historically. In that background, that's not a future depiction. That's Caesarea Philippi. That's the rock. That's the temple dedicated to Caesar behind him. A false god, falsely worshipped. Peter is a Kepha, a rock. And the church would be established. And this is the thing. It is this gift of faith, this proclamation of the truth. Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. My brothers and sisters, our whole faith hinges upon that foundation. The truth of that statement is essential. If that statement is not true, all of our hope, all of our promise is in vain. The declaration of faith that Peter makes becomes a foundation. And Peter receives the name of a foundation, rock, Kepha. It's beautiful, I said, that the information that Peter speaks about who God is, the second reading today reveals how mysterious God is. Who can understand him? Who seeks out? Who knows and gives counsel to God? No one. God is so mysterious. He's so much greater than this that he must reveal himself to us. This gift of self-revelation culminating in Jesus Christ. So knowing God, to know oneself in him. How does that sit with you, my brothers and sisters? That someone that you're going to be defined by another. I'll put it that way. It's got a little edge on it when I say it that way. Our experience of being defined by others can be both good and bad. Experience of growing up in a small town. That's what my example I used to say, but I could say the same thing. Growing up in Wyandotte County, everybody knows you. You are known. You are known. We know where you are. We know who babysat you. We know who changed your diapers. We know your mom, your grandpa, your grandma. We know you. You're locked in. You cannot change your future destiny. You will only be this. You will always be that. That doesn't sound very comforting, does it? And so in our culture, we have this beautiful thing of saying, oh no, in our culture, in our society, there's this ability to become something greater than you are. Greater than the past, greater than this, more prosperous than that present. That's wonderful. Beautiful thought. Very encouraging. Very hopeful. But neither one of those, my brothers and sisters, this is the thing. This is a half-truth that is spoken and declared over us, right? A half-truth. Why do I say it's a half-truth? Because neither one of those realities is grounded in truth. It's not grounded in truth. I can imagine myself being something so far beyond what I grew up, but if it's not grounded in truth, it's just another illusion. It's as bad as the first illusion. Truth becomes that sticking point. Truth becomes that the one that created us, the one that loves us, the one that knows us, revealing the truth of who you are. To create the illusion of deprecation or exaltation requires that we keep that idea alive. You know how hard it is to keep something that does not exist alive? How much effort and energy, like a vampire, it sucks from you in order to continue to exist. It doesn't exist. Who you are before God, before His loving gaze, before His mercy, before His love, is the one that exists and is known and loved. There's something so beautiful, so wonderful about God revealing Himself and us being revealed in it. The beauty of it all, my brothers and sisters, is not that the conclusion of the God who poured Himself out in love and gave Himself and emptied Himself in love for us is somehow going to reveal that we're a pile of... Some of us would easily agree with that, and that's not true. Our experience of life, our experience of brokenness, our experience of our shortcomings and our inability, we could agree with that, but that's not true. And the one that exalts themselves, I am this, I am that, I am this, not true. The truth of who we are. Simon, son of Jonah, you've been known as Simon, son of Jonah for so long, you are now going to be Kepha. God revealing him, this is who you are, this is what you will be. Abide in that truth. My brothers and sisters, this is such a gift. It's such an incredible gift. It is not to constrain you. It's not to limit your freedom. But it is to give you a foundation to which you can build your entire life upon. And it doesn't matter if you have that job or this car or these friends or that relationship or you live in this place or that place. It matters not. You are known. You are known. You are known in God. All of your life can be built upon that. It is His gift to us that we receive and abide in that truth. It's interesting, my brothers and sisters, because we can, as I said, we can be lied to a lot. We can have our own understandings. Example in the gospel, I'll say this. Do you understand when it says that the gates of hell shall not prevail against that church, right? So what do we think, right? You know, we're on the defensive, right? The church is being attacked, right? It's not what that says. It says the gates of hell will not prevail. Gates are defensive. They're not offensive, right? You don't run through a field putting gates, you know, and the enemy's like, oh, the gates are coming. The gates are coming, you know? No, gates are defensive. You see, God's revealing that the truth is that the church has something to proclaim, and we are going forth to destroy the kingdom of darkness by the proclamation of truth. Oh, I had that wrong. Huh, we have those things wrong within our hearts. That changes something within us when we abide in that truth. Little example. Gates are not defensive, or they are not offensive, they are defensive. The church has got a gospel message to go forth in power and strength. And hell is going to lose. And it's going to be robbed. So my brothers and sisters, to know God, to be known by Him, and to abide in that truth, it sets us free. It sets us free. It is the foundation for our lives. Amen.